the creative principle. Two is Vishnu, the preserving principle. And three is Shiva, the destroying principle. And Shiva is very important here. Shiva is always represented in Hindu imagery as a yogi. He is the destroyer in the sense of being the liberator, the cracker of shells so that chickens can come forth, the breaker up of mothers so that their children can be unsmothered, the liberative destruction, the bonfire. That's why devotees of Shiva like to do their meditations along the banks of the Ganges where they burn dead bodies. Because through destruction, life is constantly renewed. Shiva has a paramour, and her name is Kali, but that is a different word than this Kali. You mustn't confuse the two. And Kali is much worse than Shiva. She is black, and she has a long, long tongue, and her eye teeth are like fangs, but she's very beautiful otherwise. Has a lovely figure, but she's black. And in one hand, her right hand, she carries a scimitar, and in her left, she carries a severed head hanging by the hair. And Kali, who is Shiva's, you see, Shiva is normally considered wedded. All the gods have their paramours, and they're all examples of the one central self. She's called Parvati, but that's her bright aspect. But her dark aspect is Kali. And Kali is the awful awfuls, the thing above all that men most dread. Kali is outer darkness. Kali is the end. She may be represented as a blood-sucking octopus, as a spider mother that eats its spouse. And Kali is the principle of total night. And yet there are those in India like Sri Ramakrishna for whom Kali is the supreme mother goddess. Because she is two-faced, she is playful and terrifying, loving and devouring. Destroyer and savior. And the cult of Kali has its importance, helping one to see the light principle in the very depths of darkness. I have some suggestions for meditation on Kali, which you can all practice very easily. You go to the aquarium and you find out there the monsters of the deep that make you feel most uncomfortable, and you study them. So in this way, Kali is studied by her devotees. And if you meditate on those, this will be like putting manure on the soil. And out of all this apparently morbid and dismal thinking, bright things will begin to arise. Because you will realize that what Kali is the most far-out act that the Supreme Self can put on. The symbol of complete alienation from itself. So what happens, you see, is this. In the process of the game of hide-and-seek, the Supreme Self tries to see how far out it can get. Just like children like to sit around and have a competition as to who can make the most hideous face. And so, this gets worse and worse as the time cycle goes on, until at the end of the Kali Yuga, Shiva puts in an appearance, and he's all black and he has 10 arms, and he dances a dance called the Tandava. And in dancing the Tandava, the whole universe is destroyed in fire. But of course, as Shiva, having done this wreckage, turns around to leave the stage, you find that on the back of his head is the face of Brahma, the creator. And it starts again. Well, now, you see, this involves certain ideas that are quite alien to the West. One, the idea of the world as play. Our Lord God in the West tends to be over-serious. And no great Christian artist has ever painted a laughing Christ or a smiling Christ. Nothing that I've seen of any of the great masters. Always, this figure is tragic and has that sort of look in the eye which says, one of these days, you and I have got to get together for a very serious talk. So you see, there is some difficulty about the notion of the world as dramatic play for us. There's another difficult notion here, and that is cyclic time. See, most of us live in linear time. This originated with St. Augustine and his interpretation of the Bible. Now, I don't know how true this really is, but it's certainly a big fashion in modern scholarship to say that it was Judaism that gave us the idea of history. Hindus have no interest in history whatsoever, or not until recent times. To the total exasperation of historians, there is no way of finding textual evidence of the age of most of the Hindu scriptures, because they aren't interested in history as such. They are only interested in human events as archetypal occurrences, as repetitions of the great mythological themes over and over again. So if in a document started out that a certain adventure happened to King so-and-so, whom everybody knew at the time, in the next generation, they had changed the name of that king to the current king, because the story was typical anyway. They just wanted to say a king everybody knew. They altered things in that way, and so they know no kind of chronology. And if you ask even quite intelligent Asians about this, they have difficulty in understanding what kind of a question you're asking. What is this history thing? Whereas on the other hand, according to our scholars, the Jews were historically minded because they remembered the story of their descent from Adam and Abraham, the great event of the liberation from Egypt, and then the triumphant reign of King David, and then things go sliding downhill as other political forces become stronger and stronger. And so they get fixed on the idea that one day is going to be the day of the Lord, and the Messiah will come and put an end to history. And there will be the restoration of paradise. But this is linear. They don't think of the world having been created many, many times before and come to an end many, many times before. It's one clear ascent from start to finish, from Alpha to Omega. Well, when St. Augustine was thinking about this, he thought, if time is cyclic, Jesus would have to be crucified for the salvation of the world once in every cycle. But for some reason, he had it firmly fixed into his head that there was only one historical crucifixion in time. What they call the one full, perfect, sufficient sacrifice, oblation, and satisfaction for the sins of the whole world. Once is enough. Now, of course, he got his hierarchies confused. It's true, there is one sacrifice, but that's on the plane of eternity. on the plane of time, eternal things can be repeated again and again and again. But so, as a result of that, we are handed down, not a Greek, the Greeks also had cyclic time, like the Hindus, but we have been handed down linear time, and therefore we are always thinking of a progression that will take us steadily, 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 faster and faster to a more and more perfect world. And it will get better and better and better and better all the way along if we keep our heads. Now, this shows, I think, a rather naive view of human nature. Human beings tend to smash what they create and say, let's do it again. There is that in man which is also in the child. Rub it out. What fun.
And so it isn't really too realistic to suppose that human beings will simply get better and better and better and better and better, because they'll soon get tired of it. They say, let's be as awful as possible. See, there was that element in Nazism. How awful can you get? How brutal can you be? How destructive? And that, it isn't just Germans, you know, who have that. See, we are converting all the living world around us into excrement and pretending it doesn't happen that way. And we are the most marvelous vortices in this stream of food which whirls around as us and then disappears into excrements which again fertilize the soil, and we keep on at it. So you see, there is that thing in us which is represented by Shiva Kali, and it's always there. The Hindu looks at the world with very, very hard-boiled realism in this way and sees terror and magnificence, love and fury as two faces of the same thing. And you could say, well, is there any peace possible? After you've looked at this picture for a long, long time, and you've conceived the endless, endless cycles, because this thing goes on always and always and always. Per omnia saecula saeculorum, world without end. And the Hindu sometimes feels, oh, Brahma, don't you ever get tired of it? No. Because Brahma doesn't have to remember anything. And you only get tired of things you remember. That's why, from the standpoint of Brahma, there's no time. Only an eternal now. So the secret of waking up from the drama, the endless cycles, is the realization that the only time that there is the present. And when you become awake to that, boredom is at an end, and you are delivered from the cycles. Not in the sense that they disappear, that you no longer go through them. You do go through them. But you know, you realize that they're not going anywhere. Now then, supposing you liken the rhythm of these cycles to music,
Why, surely, you don't hurry it up. You don't say, let's get to the end faster. You know how to listen to music only when you slow down time and sit back and let that be. And so, in the same way, you can see every little detail of life in a new way. You say, oh my, look at that. And so one's eyes are opened in astonishment by being living totally here and now.
This concludes session 9 of Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Our program continues with session 10. True presents Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Session 10, The World as Self, Part 2, with Alan Watts.
I started out yesterday to discuss what the self means in Hindu philosophy, the principle tat tvam asi, that art thou, meaning that the self is the basis of all being. And being is not something into which we come, but out of which we proceed. In popular language, we say, I came into this world, as if you came from somewhere else altogether, from outside. But you don't. You come out of this world, just in the same way as the leaves come from the tree. And so in that way you are an expression of it, and the self meaning itself. Self meaning identity. Self meaning basis, ground, is what everybody fundamentally is. Then I went on to discuss the world as the self in the sense of the cosmos as the self, the great cycles of time in which, according to Hindu philosophy and mythology, the world is manifested and then again withdrawn. And now I want to go on to discuss the human world as the self. Well, now, there have, in the known history of mankind, been about 3 types of culture. We'll call them hunting cultures, agrarian cultures, and industrial cultures. The hunting culture seems to have been the earliest. And agrarian cultures arose when hunters learned to farm and therefore had to settle in certain places. And it was then that men built cities. And when we pass from the hunting to the agrarian culture, we notice 2 very important changes occur. In the hunting culture, every man is expert in the whole culture. That's because he spends a good deal of time alone in the forests or on the hills. And so he has to know how to make clothes, how to cook, how to build, how to fight, ride, and all those things. But as soon as people become settled in cities, we get a division of labor. Because it's obviously more practical when you're all living together for some people to specialize in some things